basically I have such a very different view on it that you really can't say that I'm just someone out there who is telling stories about Bigfoot, because I shy away from that. I'm not that camp. That's why I very carefully entitled my book Recasting Bigfoot. I'm not destroying it, but I am changing the very appearance of the entire pursuit.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm doing.
If you say you believe in Bigfoot, if you say you believe in Sasquatch, but you don't believe in one of these crucial vignettes, you're a heretic, and I've been called that.
When I say that I'm okay, well, they look at me kind of strange.
People have expressed their shock that I'm saying that this 5-foot-tall... Oh, how to clean it up. How to clean this up on radio.
Go ahead and say whatever you want.
This crap-flinging anthropoid... And why one has to talk about that is really you have to get this image of the cone-headed Yeti walking on its hind legs out of everybody's mind.
Right.
That's essential before we divide up what we're looking for. You know, we are not looking for this. We have to get rid of this fake image. We have to get the enigma back, because the enigma is very true. He truly believed that the Sasquatch and the Yeti were one and the same thing, and that's where it began.
That's where the problems began, it seems.
That's where the problems began. That's when, perfectly put. My book at least stands as evidence. Someone said this long before one of these is captured and then used for either too little or too much by the press.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big thanks to all the folks who joined us last week for the season premiere of BOA Audio Season 6, and thanks to all the great people out there who have been spreading the word about the return of BOA Audio. This week we are coming at you with a real barn burner of a program. We're going to be tearing at the fabric of the Bigfoot enigma with acclaimed researcher Gian Cassar, author of the sure-to-be-controversial Recasting Bigfoot, Uncovering the Truth About Sasquatch Amidst the Hype of Bigfoot. This book has just been released. I was honored to have been sent an advanced copy by Gian because I was really interested in what he had to say. And when I sat down to read the book, I was just completely stunned and blown away by where he goes with his research. Since Gian sent me a review copy ahead of time, we lucked out, and this is his first ever interview on the new book, Recasting Bigfoot. So you're going to get some seriously fresh and new information here on the program. Let me give you a little rundown of what we're going to be talking about. First, the big picture here is that Gian is going to detail his remarkable thesis, which suggests that the current conception of the North American Bigfoot is fundamentally wrong, and that many of the creatures called Bigfoot around the world are really a variety of undiscovered bipedal primates. And amidst all that, Neanderthal/feral humans are also lurking and adding to the Sasquatch mythos. Take a moment now and think about what I just said. That's some seriously provocative stuff from Gian Cassar. Along the way here in this conversation, he's going to take us step by step through the process by which Bigfoot was created in contemporary folklore. He's going to blow up the popular vision of the creature and replace it with an altogether different, yet still quite enigmatic, series of beasts. Along the way, we're going to talk about the Native American legends of Sasquatch, the early years of Bigfoot research, the Patterson film, The Antics of Ray Wallace, and creatures such as the Loisi, the Almas, the Abominable Snowman, the Skookum, the Tale of the Wild Woman Zaina, and the Russian studies of their mysterious creatures. Plus, of course, and as always, tons and tons more. It is a mind-blowing edition of the program that constitutes a must-hear episode for anyone even remotely interested in the Sasquatch phenomenon, as Gian Cassar shares his challenging, enlightening, and fearless research. It is definitely going to be an instant classic edition of BOA Audio, and one that is sure to generate discussion and debate for weeks, months, and probably years to come. I would be remiss if I did not mention that Gian Cassar has appeared on the program in the past, way back in Season 4, around this time of year, as a matter of fact, in a two-part edition of the program, talking about his exhaustive research into the Bermuda Triangle. If you haven't checked out that two-parter, you're definitely going to want to go back and give it a listen, because you rarely hear the Bermuda Triangle discussed on shows out there anymore, and we devoted a serious chunk of Season 4 to that topic when we welcomed Gian Cassar to the program on his first visit. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Gian Cassar, allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Gian Cassar is recognized as the leading authority in the world on the mystery of the Bermuda Triangle, the man responsible for taking the subject out of the haze of two decades of debunker-driven obscurity and placing it in its actual and often disturbing light. Gian's tendency for finding every scrap available has gained him popular recognition as Generation X's number one investigator of the most famous phenomena topics long established by the 1970s, uncovering them for an entirely new generation, but now with actual documentation instead of the endless hype and hyperbole of their public marketing. He presents them as all facts must be presented in a mature and objective manner. His website is www.bermuda-triangle.org. Pretty simple, bermuda-triangle.org. Gian has a whole section on his website devoted to recasting Bigfoot, so you can find out a whole bunch more information on the new book and how to get your hands on it there, so be sure to check it out. With all that said, folks, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on November 23rd, 2010. Gian Cassar talking about his research into the Bigfoot phenomena on BOA Audio, Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio, Season 6. I am just thrilled this week to have this interview on tap for you folks. Our guest was on the program a couple of years ago talking about the Bermuda Triangle. He is, of course, really the world's preeminent Bermuda Triangle researcher. And we did a two-week episode, two-parter, that covered his exhaustive research into the Bermuda Triangle. And at the end of that interview, he teased what we're going to be talking about here on this week's edition of the program. He said he was casting his eye towards Bigfoot and Sasquatch and, you know, the whole bipedal hominid issue with a new book that he was working on. And at that time, I was like, this sounds amazing. I can't wait to hear it, because I knew it was going to be controversial. And as I can gather from having read it over the last couple days, it is certainly going to create quite a stir in the world of cryptozoology. Let me first, of course, introduce him. He is the author of Into the Bermuda Triangle. As I said, he is one of the world's preeminent Bermuda Triangle researchers. He also got a new book out, They Flew Into Oblivion, which details the Flight 19 story that is really huge and famous, of course, for its attachment to the Bermuda Triangle. But the book we're going to be talking about here this week is Recasting Bigfoot, Uncovering the Truth About Sasquatch Amidst the Hype of Bigfoot. And, of course, he is Gian Cassar. Welcome back to the program, buddy. I am really looking forward to talking to you here on the show this week.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
We started out with the bio background last time we talked to you, and so folks can go back and check that out. What I really want to know here to start things out in this conversation is, you know, as I said in the introduction, you're the world's preeminent Bermuda Triangle researcher. So what made you decide to look at Bigfoot? They're so, you know, disparate. They're so far across the divide of the paranormal.
Well, originally I always wanted to be billed as typical of Generation X. We grew up in the 1970s with all the phenomena unexplained that was so popular back then, the old Sunshine classic documentaries and In Search Of, and I finally got interested in 1990 to stop being a spectator and look into the stuff myself. And so it's really for the Bermuda Triangle I became quite well known, but I was doing Bigfoot at the same time. I just seldom spoke about it. It's not something that is easy to just, it's not a question of finding documents and comparing data. You have to talk to people, you have to go out on the hunt, it's not something very easy to film someone doing. I've been asked to do documentaries for 10 years now, and I've actually declined because I know that business too well.
Bigfoot documentaries, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And they want to, you know, sit you on the side of a road under a tree, and you're a talking head again. They don't wish to go with you and actually go look on expedition. Well, a couple do, so I am going to be doing a couple of documentaries, History, TLC, and actually possibly another independent pilot being done. So people are going to see me more frequently as a searcher for Bigfoot. But basically, I have such a very different view on it that you really can't say that I'm just someone out there who is telling stories about Bigfoot, because I shy away from that. I'm not that camp. That's why I very carefully entitled my book "Recasting Bigfoot." I'm not destroying it, but I am changing the very appearance of the entire pursuit.
Yeah. I mean, that's an understatement. I mean, this book completely blew my mind. I'm just completely blown away by what you're saying here in this book. I grew up sort of in the school of the flesh and blood, mysterious animal. And over time, having studied this in the paranormal field, I sort of turned more into the interdimensional end. And then reading this book, you've kind of pulled me in a whole different direction that I never would have even considered. I need to give it a whole, like, second look. You've given it a whole fresh look, really. You've reshaped the fabric of this in my eyes and in my mind for this.
But that's a great compliment. It can be paid.
Yeah, dude, it's amazing. I mean, it's really, folks who are interested in Bigfoot should go out and get this book, because it completely just blasts away the paradigm of Bigfoot, what it's all about, and what the hell really happened here.
That's why he's never been found, because no one really ever went looking for the actual entities behind this. They were looking for this cone-headed ape-man Gigantopithecus, which is absolutely not anything the Indians spoke about. It's not what has been reported in America in any old journal. It is, you can probably pinpoint the day that the Yeti, that's what people really think this thing is, that the Yeti stepped across the Pacific Ocean and landed in America with an entirely different foot and a different makeup job, and it's simply so much pernicious folklore.
Yeah, it casts a huge blow to the, I guess you could say, American Bigfoot and, you know, that whole romanticized Pacific Northwest aspect of it, of America. I guess let's just sort of dive into the book here, because I've got a ton of notes on it, and I really devoured it, because I've always been a Bigfoot enthusiast, or I guess we should call it more Sasquatch, because that's sort of the,
Well, it's become so intertwined now, we have to dissect
the nomenclature.
What is Sasquatch and what is Bigfoot?
Yeah, absolutely.
What should we call Bigfoot, and what should we call Sasquatch?
Well, I guess let's start out with, I guess, your general thesis, I think, and that is, I'm going to try and sum it up best here, and feel free to obviously extrapolate and correct me if I'm wrong. I think what you're trying to say in the book is that, based on J.W. Byrne's research in Western Canada back in the day in the early 1900s, mm-hmm. and his interaction with the, I guess you could call them Native Canadians, they said that there were two tribes of these wild men, one sort of like a feral human, I guess is sort of the best way to put it, in terms of people would kind of understand, and the other being sort of a man-beast, a primate of sorts. So one was sort of like, could communicate and interact more with people, and the other was really just more of a wild animal almost.
As we would have to dissect it, the Indians insisted they were humans. Mm-hmm. And one of the tribes could speak Douglas, or something akin to the Douglas dialect, which would be the Indian tribal dialect. What the earliest Bigfooters, and this is all very innocent on their part, I'm not being acrimonious, but the earliest Bigfooters completely overlooked the entire concept of two tribes. That the Indians were explicit, there were two tribes of Sasquatch, mm-hmm. what they called Sasquatch men. Sasquatch is merely J.W. Byrne's anglicized word for the Chinook jargon, Sasquaha George. That's as stunning as Sasquatch is. Sasquaha Chach is how the Indians would have pronounced George, Chach.
Okay.
King George was Kinchach, and Britain was Kinchachaili, that was King George Island. So Sasquaha was the district name in British Columbia before it was known as the Chehalis District. and it means place of the wild man. So Sasquaha George was the wild man of the Sasquaha district. And from their pronunciation, that's where we get Sasquatch. And so white man overlooked that the Indians definitely spoke of people. We innocently mixed all this kind of Indian artwork and stories, old journals of, well, what is it, of a hairy, who knows what it is. Old newspaper journals talked about something that was kind of after the fashion of a human. They were called animal humans. They were hairy. They were man-sized. The Indians insisted Sasquaha George was a giant, but to them, the shorter races of the Pacific Northwest, it meant 6.5 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And if you even go down to the Apaches in Arizona and so forth, they're shorter too. They think 6.5 foot tall Europeans are giants. And that was clarified by J.W. Burns, the Indian agent for the territory that introduced us to the stories of his beloved Indians, that these were people, they're 6.5 tall, and that's giant to the Indians. Well, to us, giant, of course, means something bigger. It means something 8 or 9 feet tall. And so the whole concept spread amongst the whites, and that these were giant Indians or whatever. And so they had a fairy tale image to them, even though the Indian stories really are not much of a fairy tale. But when, in 1951, is when it really, I should backtrack, J.W. Burns wrote his first article for McLean's magazine in 1929, the April edition. And so throughout the 1930s, he finally brought to the whites a clarification of these old Indian stories of the Sasquatch. And this became quite a fascinating thing for Canadian whites. It became a fairy tale to them. It was a wonderful bit of folklore. And nobody was really sure what the truth was behind it. Those who wished to believe it thought they were just giant Indians who lived a very primitive lifestyle.
Yeah.
And but then in 1951, something that was very world famous. It was, no one really heard about the Sasquatch in America. Bigfoot, of course, was unknown at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But something was very world famous, and that was the Yeti, the abominable snowman. And the British were all over that. That was one of the delights of Britain. The very respected anthropologists were sure that this could be Gigantopithecus, which merely means giant ape, that this was some kind of bipedal prehistoric ape that had survived, that this could show us how evolution happened. The Yeti and abominable snowman were considered one and the same thing. And it was just so enormously popular. In 1951, it took on a very real persona when Eric Shipton and Michael Ward on the 1951 Everest expedition photographed these very bizarre footprints. And this is to this day, the Shipton photo is believed to hold the print of an unknown bipedal primate. It has a very strange footprint. It's hard to describe. You merely have to look at the picture. It's a famous picture. And that is believed to be the Yeti footprint. And there was two of them that walked down the glaciers. They followed the footprints, Michael Ward and Eric Shipton. And they took a picture of the clearest one. He says it was as clear as if it was imprinted in wax. And this electrified the world. Here was proof finally of the abominable snowman. And it was everywhere. The Daily Mail of Britain sponsored this huge expedition of six qualified researchers and 250 Sherpas, the guides in Nepal, and they went up into the Himalayas.
6 months, right? That's how long it was?
I believe it was, yes.
Yeah, that's amazing when you think about it in today's no one's putting that kind of work into getting these things.
The 1954 Daily Mail-inspired Yeti expedition, and it inspired motion pictures and all sorts of things. Well, at that same time, in 1915, December, when the Daily Mail was announcing this worldwide, a very young Swiss immigrant to Canada named René Dehinden, whom almost anybody in Bigfootery knows who that was, he became one of the greatest Bigfooters there was. He heard these announcements, and his boss in Calgary, Canada, said, "Those things are in British Columbia. You don't have to go all the way to the Himalayas to find them." And that really got him started. And when he moved west to Vancouver, he was doing all this research. He truly believed that the Sasquatch and the Yeti were one and the same thing, and that's where it began.
That's where the problems began, it seems.
That's where the problems began. That's when, perfectly put, when the Sasquatch began to lose its, I mean, it was still a fairy tale to many whites. The Hinden tried to get a new newspaper man to the Sasquatch area in Agassiz, a named John Green involved, and he was skeptical. But things began to happen. In 1958, British Columbia would celebrate its centenary, and people were wondering what cultural symbol should be used to celebrate this. And, of course, the Sasquatch was one of them. It was so famous there. And this is what got everybody talking about Sasquatch. And although Green poo-pooed the whole idea that this was some kind of Yeti from the Himalayas that had migrated over the Bering Land Bridge, we've all heard of that theory where all the old world animals came over to the new world, that this happened in some ancient time. He heard from a friend of his this interesting story, and that was the famous Ruby Creek story, what became the famous Ruby Creek story, the Chapmans, the Indians who had their own farm at Ruby Creek, 12 miles up from Agassiz, and in 1941, this incident happened in which Jeannie Chapman, the mother, saw the Sasquatch. The children, the little girl Rosie ran in first. This giant man, she called a giant hairy man, was walking across the field, came to the farm where they lived, and the husband was gone at that time. So she took her children, used the house as a shield, and took them down to the creek and got them two friends. And that the Sasquatch walked around the area, because George Chapman came back, found his family gone. He followed the tracks. It got into the outshed. It broke into a barrel of salmon, salted salmon, and ate on it. Apparently went down to the river, washed the salt off, walked over the Canadian Pacific Railroad fence, 1 foot on one side, 1 foot on the other, and that's a 48-inch tall fence. And that's how big this thing was. Jeannie Chapman estimated it was 7.5 feet tall, had an unusually small head for its size. And that terrified her. It came back several times during the week, and she finally said, forget it. And the family moved, and the entire farm went fallow and finally dilapidated. John Green heard the story, and he started backtracking all this. Found out a newspaper article mentioned it in 1941, in which it condemned it as a 10-foot-tall bear, one of the largest ever. And then he found out the man he already knew by the name of Gustav Tifting was one of the two men who actually went out there and investigated the farm afterward, because the Indians were so excited about a report of Sasquatch. I mean, this was the Vancouver province that even reported this. Mm-hmm. That's how big a stir was created. Turns out that one of our deputy sheriffs in Washington, Joe Dunn, went over because he heard about these things and was very interested. And with Tifting, they went out to the farm, traced the tracks from the forest, found out, you know, were in the outshed, examined the salmon, walked around, followed the whole thing, followed it over the fence, was amazed that this thing simply stepped over a 48-inch fence, 1 foot on one side, 1 foot on the other, went over the railroad track and up a mountain. And Dunn was smart enough to trace one of the footprints. They were 2 inches deep in the potato patch. They crushed the potatoes underneath, and he did a perfect tracing of this. And John Green found Dunn's son. Dunn had passed away by 1957 when Green was starting to investigate. Found Dunn's son, saw the original tracing, and was able to trace the footprint. And we had, for the first time, an actual tracing of the fabled Sasquatch foot. Well, it's not a human foot at all. It's nothing even close. It's humanoid. It's a long foot. Long heel. But the thing is, it's no Yeti footprint. It's nothing close to the Yeti. A human footprint is closer than the Yeti.
Mm-hmm.
But this started it all, and why it's a long introduction to how this all happened is very significant, is that Bigfoot then happened in 1958, and that was just nationwide news. That was at Bluff Creek, far from the Sasquatch. These enlarged human footprints turned up in Northern California in the Klamath Mountains in October 1958, and John Green went down to investigate, and he couldn't believe it at first. He talked to people. He talked to someone named Bob Titmus, who became another famous Bigfooter, and they were just unbelievable to him, these large footprints, and he finally went back again in November when more footprints appeared on the sandbar, and he was convinced. And this, the Humboldt Times, which dished out every story coming from the logging areas in Northern California, got all this world news with the AP, Bulletin, everything. And Green was certain that this was a Sasquatch. And with DeHinden and he becoming friends now, Green now believed that the Sasquatch were not giant hairy Indians. They were not a myth. They were real. And what's worse, they were a Yeti. And a Yeti and a Sasquatch was the same thing. And the Bigfoot of California must be the same thing as well.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's sort of like the integral point of cryptozoology that you try to, or you do blow up in the book. And that's that the popular misconception for many people who have sort of a peripheral interest in cryptozoology seem to think that they say outright that the Yeti is the Bigfoot, and the Bigfoot is the Sasquatch, and the Sasquatch is the Yowie, and the Yowie is the Almas, and the Almas is this, and it's all the same thing. But what you're saying in the book is that no, we're not dealing with the same thing. We're dealing with a whole host of possible different creatures.
Very different things, and the history bears that out. There is no talk of the giant cone-headed ape man amongst the Indians. There is no image of that in all their artwork. Their artwork is actually very explicit. And that's where Bigfooters made the mistake again. They went to Indian artwork. John Green had a great knack, a very laudable knack, of digging up old newspaper articles and finding wonderful research about Paul Kane's journal of 1847 talking about the Skookum, which were around Mount St. Helens in Washington State. About the Oma of Northern California, which were thought, well, this must be the truth behind Bigfoot. That's what Bigfoot, oh, must be an Oma, and an Oma is a Sasquatch, and a Skookum is a Sasquatch, and they're all one and the same thing, and they're scientifically Gigantopithecus, which they try to make it sound very, that's the scientific point of view. Well, no, it's what they try and make look scientific. But the truth is, the Indian artwork does not identify the Yeti at all, and neither do the footprints. I mean, there is a stark difference between the Yeti footprint as established by Shipton and the Yeti expedition. The Sasquatch footprint is radically different from that. It cannot even be a variation of the same species. It is an entirely different entity. And the Bigfoot, as we know Bigfoot, the Bluff Creek Bigfoot, basically has been exposed since, and we can say it was Ray Wallace. It was Jerry Crew's loss. Jerry Crew found these footprints. It was his boss and his brother, Ray and Wilbur. And that's what, so people think Bigfoot has been exposed because Ray Wallace, in the obituary confession, his family confessed he was the one who made these footprints at Bluff Creek. Well, that muddled everything, but that did not destroy Bigfoot. That just destroyed a very garish incarnation that rode piggyback on the legends of the Oma and the Skookum and the Sasquatch.
Right, right. But the point you make in the book, though, is that that piggyback was just immensely detrimental to the entire concept of trying to understand and find this thing.
Yes, that is the popular image, that Bigfoot is this conehead, and he's Bluff Creek is his shrine. And this has given us the image of the Sasquatch, the thing from the Patterson film. The Yeti with the cone head and the female breasts walking away from the camera. And that is what destroyed the whole image. Finally, by that time, the pedigree of Bigfoot was established by the early 70s, thanks to everything at Bluff Creek, to the Bigfooters' terrible misconceptions, and then to the Patterson film, which electrified the world. And that gave us Bigfoot. That is the Bigfoot of today. And he's gotten bigger. He's 8-9 feet tall. He's all over the world now, although the Indians said the last surviving remnant of the Sasquatch were in their district. The Indians, to Paul Kane in 1847, said Mount St. Helens was the remaining abode of the Skookum, a cannibal. What is it? They clarified it by enormous redundancy, the race of beings of a different species.
Yeah, I love that.
And that's the only way Paul Kane could clarify their regard for the Skookum. And so there's the problem, is that one, this enormous folklore has built up and has completely obscured the idea of two tribes of Sasquatch men, one of which indeed could have been human, but we really don't have footprints to indicate that. We have only one footprint of what we can call the Sasquatch, and that would be the Ruby Creek footprint, mm-hmm. And that is clearly belonging to something unheard of. That footprint is amazing, that long, monkey-like footprint, but no offset toe thumb. This is not any kind of ape foot. These are five toes, almost even across. It's not like a human foot at all.
Let's tackle, not just big, it's huge, huge piece of the cryptozoology world in this Americanized Bigfoot that you outright say is fake, and that's the Patterson-Gimlin film. Obviously, you're not the first person to say it's fake, but what makes you say this? I found a lot of interesting stuff from the book about, you know, you sort of dug more into the people and what they were doing at the time, and that really uncovered a lot of what looks like chicanery more than even what you can see in the film itself.
Well, it is. It's very suspicious. Logic does exist. When you're taught philosophy, as I studied philosophy as well at university, the very first things you're taught are logic, natural logic, and how all logic rides upon this, and that in all logic, your conclusions must be supported by your premises. Certain actions will lead logically to other actions. And so if you examine the behavior of people in light of what they were saying, it just does not follow suit. The claims that Patterson shot this film on October 20, 1967, and then he drives, according to, you know, Rene de Hinden was all there afterward, a new Patterson, and this comes from his own account. He was very explicit in his book in 1973 with Don Hunter, entitled Sasquatch. And here on October 20, supposedly, by their estimation, Patterson shot the film, drove all the way from Bluff Creek to Eureka, mailed it to his home in Yakima, Washington, alerted the news wires, the worldwide news wires, which were all tapped into the Humboldt Times in Eureka, listening for Bigfoot stories, and then drove all the way back to Bluff Creek, went back to the sandbar, cast the prints and covered some to keep them careful, keep them preserved, narrowly avoided a huge rainstorm and mudslide on the way out, and that's what they told Rene de Hinden, because they weren't expecting him to be in Willow Creek when they got there. He was in San Francisco, and they didn't know that. And it goes over the news wires, and he immediately drives up, and apparently Gimlin and Patterson are surprised to see him, and that's their story.
Yeah, sounds like.
You can't go to the sandbar because we just escaped a deluge.
Yeah, it's like almost like he caught them in the midst of you know, the fakery.
Yeah, and then this very improbable, illogical story comes up. You know, why would you alert the news wires when you don't know what kind of film you have? He even admitted that to Patterson. I don't know if I have anything that will stand up. And he admitted that, rather, to de Hinden. Mm-hmm. And de Hinden reported that in his own book. And now, you know, why would you alert the news wires to that?
Yeah.
And they get to Yakima the next day. The film miraculously is already developed. And it just looks, you know, great. It is actually very well done. I believe it's a hoax, but it is very well done. And it's just astounding that then 9 days later, the only person who's able to get to the site 9 days later is Bob Titmus. He drives all the way from Kitimat, 1,500 miles away. He gets out there, and he can follow everybody's tracks very easily, he said. He casts 10 prints of this Bigfoot, which, again, has different feet. These are not the feet that crew found. These are not Ray Wallace's now famous hourglass prints. These aren't Yeti footprints. These aren't Sasquatch footprints from Ruby Creek. These are radically different. These are funny, enlarged human feet. And so then he gets out there, and apparently there was no deluge because that happened. That creek bed's going to rise up and swamp the sandbar. And so just there's too much fakery there, and why one has to talk about that is really you have to get this image of the cone-headed Yeti walking on its hind legs out of everybody's mind.
Right.
That's essential before we divide up what we're looking for. You know, we are not looking for this. I'm not going out looking for this guy, this hairy guy with these funny enlarged human feet.
Exactly, yeah. I had never really known too much about, you know, the history of Bigfootery, and you really sort of introduce a lot of very interesting characters. It sounds like quite a coterie of you know, competing agendas, competing motivations, you know, competing beliefs. They all sort of seem to want to be the one to bag this thing at the same...
Yeah, whatever, for money, for glory.
Yeah.
As de Hinden admitted, that was his whole motive. Glory and hard cash prizes. Those who thought they were more of the scientific bent had some bizarre evolutionary theory that they probably thought this could prove. Others just, you know, they revel in the folklore and were trying to profit off the stories.
Yeah, yeah. It almost, especially as the book progresses, you know, and you get further into the history of the Bigfootery, it feels like almost, too, that they had been searching so long they couldn't give up. They couldn't give up on the ghost of this thing. Like,
and what's ironic is that they were looking for their own created monster, mm-hmm. and that's not what they should have been looking for. I mean, talk about the most minor comparative analysis. We'll look at the Yeti footprint from the Himalayas and the Sasquatch footprint from a Ruby Creek in British Columbia and say, listen, we don't have even the same thing. I mean, there's no... And then they had the William Rowe sighting, which is so fundamental. And that, I mean, he really gives a very clear description of something 6 foot tall. That is not the Yeti. I mean, it does not have a cone head. And it has the same type of Ruby Creek footprint. He saw the foot.
Yeah.
What, you know, so you have to ask, what kind of analytical ability were they dealing with if they could not see the difference? If they just wanted to ride piggyback on the fame of the Yeti, instead of trying to clarify, we've got something very different here.
It sounds like, from what you say in the book, that they just completely disregard the J.W. Burns material.
I don't think they knew what it was. I don't think John Green ever read J.W. Burns, because he wrote in his introduction, Meet the Sasquatch, of his first book, which I enjoy. I mean, it is the Green's first venue on the track of the Sasquatch, which he self-published in 1968. He said that white man's impression were that these were considered to be tall Indians with long hair on their head. That's what Hairy Giant meant to them. And that's nothing you're going to get out of a J.W. Burns story. He was talking about ape-like men. Hairy all over.
Yeah.
And so I don't think they'd ever read J.W. Burns. They just had the popular impression. They ran with it. They couldn't believe it was a giant primitive Indian. And so the, you know, only logical explanation was the very popular Yeti.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And that's where we have all this error. And then to justify this, they went into the Indian artwork, which is really begins to give us the entities involved. And there's that very ridiculed Amaranthropodus Loisi. People say, what? Well, it's that picture that Francois Deloy took in 1920 in Venezuela, mm-hmm. of all places, of what appears to be a 5-foot-tall anthropoid, but it looks just like a spider monkey. A spider monkey, which is a small, you know, at best they get 3 feet tall. They have a long prehensile tail. And, you know, what's that? It's no big deal. That's nothing exciting. Well, Deloy and his men said this thing was, these two of them, a male and a female, approached them by the Rio Catatumbo. And they were 5 feet tall. They walked on their hind legs. They had no tail. They picked up sticks. They brandished them. They were beating the bushes. They were freaking out in front of his party. He was there looking for petroleum signs. He was a geologist. And he, as the male stepped aside, he shot the female. The male was wounded and ran off, and they couldn't recover it, so they take the female back proper on this petroleum crate and take that picture. And he finally got out of the jungle with what was left of his party after 3 years of searching. He'd lost most of his party, and he had this one picture left. And he was mocked for it. His own story in the London Illustrated, I believe, was not believed by most. And only one major French zoologist, Professor Georges Montenon, believed him and carefully studied the picture and Deloy's report and said that Deloy shot a real anthropoid. And so he named it after him. All Amaranthropodus Loisi means is Mr. Loisi, ape-like American.
Yeah.
And no one wanted to accept that. Sir Arthur Keith was venomous. He denounced Deloy. No one had seen an ape, if you will, or an anthropoid version of a known genus of monkey. He said that you can't see the tail in the picture because either Deloy shot it off or cut it off, and he's just, it's a hoax. Well, Montenon was careful to get an exact copy of the crate on which this anthropoid was set. And he measured 17 3/4 inches. His cousin was in the oil business. He got one, and he said, this is clearly 3 1/3 times. The anthropoid is 3 1/3 times taller than this crate. It must be around 5 feet tall. And Deloy himself in his notes said it was 5 feet 1 inch 3/4 tall.
Wow.
And no one would accept this. No one, it was an enormous row. Evolution could not explain this. This is not how it works. At that time, they believed anything bipedal was a missing link. How could this be a missing link? This is something closer to primitive monkeys. This is nowhere near us. This is a new world primate. Man's an old world primate. This is a bunch of rubbish. This is a hoax. No one logically could explain why a respected geologist would go deep into Venezuela to perpetuate a zoological hoax. There was nothing in it.
Right, exactly.
And so it's been dismissed. It's been ridiculed. I have been, in some ways, people have expressed their shock that I'm saying that this 5 foot tall, how to clean this up on radio.
Go ahead and say whatever you want.
This crap-flinging anthropoid. That's what spider monkeys do. They will defecate in their hands. They'll throw the stuff at you. And these anthropoids, according to Deloitte, showed the same behavior. When they got into their big monkey fit, they did the same thing and threw it at him. And that was, you know, Merritt was all a Frenchman was going to take. And that's when he shot him. And so that is not the zing of the legend, that when people speak about the subhuman, the missing link, our berry-eating buddy, Bigfoot, they don't picture a five-foot-tall anthropoid related to a known genus of monkey that behaves in the same primitive fashion. And yet you look at the Indian artwork, and you begin to see what the Indians are talking about when it comes to Tsotsinuqua. Tsotsinuqua, as a name, is frequently raised in terms of proof of Bigfoot. This is the Indian proof of Bigfoot. John Green was the first. He took pictures of the Tsotsinuqua totems, the legends of the nude cannibal tribe in the forest, the mask, the Buquas, all these, you'll hear all these Indian names. This is all supposed to represent Bigfoot because it has ape-like appearances. Well, if you look at the Indian artwork, you'll see that the Indian artwork very accurately shows very unique features to spider monkeys and the Loisi, and that is the bony ridge. Most apes just have this huge jutting brow over their eyes. Well, spider monkeys and the Loisi have the brow go all around and circle their entire eye, so that looks like it's a round circle of bone around the eye.
Yeah.
And you will see that in the masks and totems of the Tsotsinuqua. You will see the long arms in a bodysuit and the huge hands. And then looking at these old newspaper articles, which some of the Bigfooters did ferret out to their credit, you see that there was a report in 1869 in California near Pacheco Pass, close to where I grew up at Gilroy, where the hunter came across 2 5-foot-tall, such as he calls them, what is it? He didn't know what they were, but they were male and female. And he describes them as you know, similar to what we would call the Loisi now. And then you see the report of M.S. Trimble way over in the St. Louis Democrat in 1870 as well, of a creature that it matches. And you then look at Montanon's work, and he was uncovering all this evidence in South America from the time, what, of Pedro de Leon, that something 5 foot tall, some hairy man-beast was known to be in the forest, and they travel in male-female pairs, and they're noted for their howling and whistling. And the Tsotsinuqua masks of the Pacific Northwest always picture Tsotsinuqua with the mouth puckered, as though it is moaning or whistling. And the evidence just goes on and on to show
right.
that these five-foot-tall anthropoids did, in fact, migrate through Mayan lands. The Mayans have statues of them, and they came north through California into the Pacific Northwest. And I would say in through other mountains, through the Rockies, and into Oklahoma that has reports of these, and into Arkansas where the Fauk monster was famous,
mm-hmm.
and or the skunk ape of Florida, and they follow the mountains northward. And that is so far the major evidence behind Indian artwork. Or I should say Indian artwork is the major evidence proving that Deloitte was not a crank. He shot a Tsotsinuqua. He shot the genuine article and propped it on a crate, and we've had a picture this whole time, and this picture is matched by Indian artwork.
Right.
This is not the Bigfoot of legend. This is not the 8-9-foot-tall Gigantopithecus. It's a 5-foot-tall crap-flinging ape.
Right. And by extension, it is one of the 2 tribes described by the Native Canadians to J.W. Burns. Is that accurate?
One wonders.
Okay.
I'm not sure, because, you know, the Indians didn't mix Tsotsinuqua and the Sasquatch men. We did.
Ah, okay.
We white men said, this is proof of of Bigfoot. This is proof of Sasquatch. The Indians didn't do that. They said this is Tissonaqua, and they accurately...
Oh, so it's like a whole different entity to them.
Yes, when the Indians spoke of Sasquatch, that's what I have to dissect in there. When the Indians spoke of Sasquatch, they meant people. They meant something so human, they thought it was people, or they meant people.
Okay,
very hairy, animalistic people. So I excise in my chapter Odd Anthropoid Out. That's why I call it that. We get rid of Tissonaqua now. We get rid of Amaranthropus loisi. We can identify it. It's not Bigfoot. It's not Sasquatch. This is something totally different. This was our mistake.
Ah, okay.
And the same with the Skookum. I believe the Skookum is another Native American anthropoid. And there's evidence that a lot of the Bigfoot reports, you know, the classic stuff of the 19th century, is describing something that is given very clear detail that matches yet another South American primate. And so if the Loisi is real, if there are anthropoids, apes if you must, because these are very different from old world apes. These have tall, these have long legs, because monkeys, some monkeys too, have very long hind legs. And so if you had a bipedal anthropoid very close related to monkeys, it's not surprising it would have more of a human form. It could migrate further, and it could step over a fence. It would be far more alarming to see something like that than these short little African waddlers with
yeah.
short legs.
Yeah.
No one's really going to be too scared of a chimp.
Exactly.
There's evidence that the Skookum and the Tissonaqua are two Native American anthropoids. They're not old world missing links. They're not Yeti. They're truly ours, and the Skookum apparently does get to be 6 and 7 feet tall, something like the legend, and is a hell of a lot more nastier than the Loisi ever could be. And that would be what was still living around Mount St. Helens in 1924, during the famous Ape Canyon case.
Mm-hmm.
The miners described the similar features as an old 1889 Happy Camp report, that this has prominent ears that stick out, it has a beard, it has a bulldog's head. A bulldog's head. It does not have a cone head or a rounded head. A bulldog's head, meaning the low vaulted head with the cleft in the middle.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what the howler monkey has. And Skookum, we say it's Sasquatch as well. I say it isn't. But what is Sasquatch's famous attribute? That it howls. So that's known for its eerie howling. The Indians even said Sasquatch man is known for its eerie howling. And so there's so much convolution that's why I have to go through and dissect so much until we finally boil it down to the actual two Sasquatch men. The two Sasquatch men tribes are not Skookum. They're not Amaranthropus loisi. They're not the Tissonaqua. They're not what's reflected in the artwork. There is other artwork that shows wild human beings as Buquas, which is the name for the wild man. And then there are Buquas masks, which show some kind of quasi-ape.
Yeah.
And here we finally get down to the two Sasquatch tribes, something that is human and something that is so human-like it can pass for a human to people.
Fascinating stuff, I'm telling you. Like I said, this blew my mind when I read this because it was like, what, you know, this is completely the antithesis of what, you know, mainstream America thinks about what the Bigfoot is nowadays. So it's mind-blowing.
It's unfortunate that I have to go after, you know, the popular concept of Bigfoot so much, but that is really, until that is out of our mind, we cannot see, you know, we cannot interpret the Indian artwork, we cannot interpret all those famous stone heads Othniel Marsh discovered. They show signs of the Loisi as well, the ocular area around the eye. We have to get rid of this old world Yeti Gigantopithecus walking in America because it does not exist. The Indians did not speak of something 8 feet tall. They spoke of something 6 to 6.5 feet tall, but twice the thickness of an ordinary man, and it is very human-like, and something 8 feet tall with a pointed cone head, I'm sorry, is not human-like.
Exactly.
No one is going to mistake that for a human.
Right, exactly. What you're essentially saying, I guess, in the book, too, is that you're saying the Loisi's one thing, the Skookum's another, and then by extension, also in the book, you talk about the Almas, and so we're talking about, you know, yet another different anthropoid.
Which is exclusively old world. This is not the Loisi and the Skookum, my contention would be that we could call it a spider ape and a howler ape, that those are anthropoids that are related to these genus of monkey, South American monkey.
Mm-hmm.
And we go then to the old world. to talk about the Almas, because this is about the Yeti as well. The Yeti, I believe, probably could be Gigantopithecus. There were, even Carlin Kuhn, who was Harvard's big anthropologist, thought that the Yeti was real and this footprint was Gigantopithecus, which meant a big deal back then, because Gigantopithecus back then was believed to be bipedal. It was believed to be lateral evolution, which was very popular to talk about back then. It was not related to us. It's from another simian or a simian way back, but it's a lateral line, and that later was quashed by too much controversy so that no one talked about lateral evolution. But back then, that was a big deal, that Gigantopithecus, though not a missing link, is a missing link of something else. It is proof. It's a benchmark of evolution. So it was a big deal. When anybody said Gigantopithecus, they were talking about some form of missing link. And that's why the Yeti was so popular. That's why you would get Oxford anthropologists talking about it, or Harvard anthropologists.
Right.
So Yeti is quite real, and it might be Gigantopithecus, but, you know, we have to say, listen, that's not Bigfoot, that's not Sasquatch.
Right, right.
And apparently it's not the Almas. The Almas sounds conspicuously like a rhesus monkey. It sounds like another type of anthropoid. It's got pointed ears. I mean, that is so much attested to in all the Russian studies. The Russians had very credible people, like Vasily Kokolov, looking into it, and way back when, long before us, 1910, 1907, a couple of very wonderful Mongolian naturalists, Z. Jamsharano and then J.R. Rinchen, and the description of the Almas is always the same. It's about 5 feet tall, too. Pointed ears, walks on its hind legs. It's hunched. It has a strange foot, too, with a big toe that's shorter and offset, so it sounds stranger, like an 8 foot right there. And apparently there has been a cast taken of this foot in the McNeely-Cronin expedition 1972 in the Himalayas as well, of a bipedal primate, ostensibly, and that that cast they have just is too much like what was being described by all these Russian scientists. And so this is something very different. And although the Bigfooters, De Hinden especially, insisted that the Almas, you know, this is a Yeti, this is Bigfoot, this is Sasquatch, even though the Almas has pointed ears, it's only 5 feet tall, they didn't seem to want to accept more than one entity.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to accept that it could just be an animal. It had to be something far more exciting. It had to be a missing link.
Right.
And the Russian in charge of all this, Dr. Boris Porchnev, of the Academy of Sciences, he was a historian. He's the one who dug up all this history and all this data to collate. He did this marvelous job. But because the idea of a Neanderthal in the 50s, in our days of innocent imagineering, was this, you know, they carried a club. They were hairy type of odd and Cro-Magnon, and they carried women off by the tuft of the hair. And since the gradualism was so predominant that, you know, missing links look like, you know, ape men and all that kind of stuff, if we have people describing bipedal apes, bipedal primates, well, they have to be missing links. And therefore, he was sure they were Neanderthals. And that was just, it's really, you know, out of left field, really, for the Almas. But even though the Russians had far more evidence than we have of humans involved, even the case of a captured wild human, Porchnev did the same thing. He believed everything. Almas, the people of the Caucasus, the wild man that a Russian colonel examined in 1941, who was key to helping the famous Soviet Snowman Commission, which Porchnev was the head of, they did the same thing. They lumped everything together and called it an Almas.
Yeah.
And we did the same thing, except we excluded humans. Porchnev said these were all subhumans. The Almas, the wild men, the Yeti, all the reports of Mulan and Chichuna, which were wild men in Siberia, they're all Neanderthal. And so you can imagine René de Hinden coming back from personally interviewing him in 1972, believing these were all the same that we have here. So that indeed Bigfoot is now a Neanderthal, even though, I'm sorry, Neanderthals never had a tall cone head, nor were they 8 feet tall. You know, everything was just so mixed and maxed and convoluted.
Yeah, that's what I got out of the book, really. It's like there's a lot of sort of like pulling at these threads to try and figure out exactly what's really going on here, because everything gets so confabulated.
It is. I mean, that's why you have to probe into the world of hairy hominids, which is what it's, you know, jokingly called. But that's what this comes down to, is that the people who did look into this were not the establishment. They were not worried about that much academic oversight. And so I think any credible, real credible anthropologist at the time would have said, listen, you've got more than one thing. If these are real, you've got way more than one thing involved here.
Yeah.
This thing with the pointed ears and the thin chest around Mongolia and so forth, this is not some Neanderthal. That's not what they look like. We have their skeletons. We know that. And then the idea of this 8-9-foot-tall thing in America, and then this Yeti, the Yeti that is so famous for its tall, pointed head, I mean, that's not a Neanderthal either. What is so numbing is how the Bigfooters ran with all this and said it is all one and the same thing. They morphed it into the giant 8-9 feet tall because the Indians called it a giant, and that's our image of Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And that is our explanation. Worse, our explanation for Bigfoot is that, you know, it's everything. Basically, it's the Gigantopithecus, it's Neanderthal, it's whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And people are lost. The masks the Indians have of the Bukwas that clearly show wild human beings with very different features than Indians, than whites, than Negroes, than anything the Indians would have had contact with. These are very different human beings. Thick-lipped, strange features, sunken eyes, high cheekbones, exactly as the Russians described that captured wild woman in the Caucasus in the 19th century, which they did believe was a Neanderthal.
Yeah, tell that story, because I've heard it in other places before, but I don't think we've ever had anybody share this tale on the show before. I'd love for people to hear it.
The famous story of Zana, that's the name she was given. Dr. Porchniff did an incredibly reputable research on this, because that was his kink, believing, and everything was a Neanderthal. And so they heard about this wild woman who had lived in the Caucasus in the 1860s or 70s. She was captured in what was only called an age-old method. She was finally subdued, which means they beat her pretty good and gagged her mouth. She was so wild. They brought her to the reigning prince of that area. He kept her for a while as an oddity. He gifted her to another vassal. And then it basically went to someone named Ganava, who took her and still had to pen her up at his own farm in the Caucasus Mountains, which is in the, what was then the Soviet Union. Well, what became the Soviet Union after the revolution in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
Finally she was tamed, possibly after a lot of beatings. She was named Zana, which means dark or negroid in that language. And she was described as a very dark-skinned, thick lips. She had long hair on her head, almost like a Gibson on top. It was very, very thick, like a cap, and it went all the way down her back to her lower back. She was found completely naked, hairy all over, black, reddish hair, fiery type of eyes, which could be an exaggeration, of course. But she had no human expression. She was just bestial and scared everybody. When she was taken into town by Ganava, dogs couldn't even stand her, and she hated dogs. And so she could never learn any words. She did primitive chores about the house, about the farm, I should say. She never could be indoors. She could not handle warm rooms. She slept outside and didn't like clothes. And so it sounds like we're almost talking about an animal.
Yeah.
And that's what we'd probably denounce this as, mostly myth and folklore, or some confusion, primitive people that didn't understand what an ape was or something. Well, no, Dr. Porchniff decided to journey there in the late 1950s or early 1960s, I believe, and investigate this for himself. He wanted to find her grave, believing if he found the bones, he could prove she was a Neanderthal.
Yeah.
A living Neanderthal. He comes across the village. He talks to people who still remembered her, and some who were still at her funeral, who were still alive. And he got the description I gave to you. And then he went to a nearby village and Amazingly, he was told the story that she actually had half-breed children, as they call it, half-breed children. She apparently wasn't too ugly for some of the more desperate guys in the village. But she did conceive children. She went to the river to wash them off and drown them in the process. And so the village intervened and saved subsequent children.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did have four children. And poor Schniff went and he got to meet a couple of her grandchildren. One, Shalakula. He was struck by the appearance that he had more of a Negroid appearance, but straight hair, thicker lips, thick set. He could pick up a chair with a person sitting in the chair, and he could pick up the chair by the leg with his teeth.
Wow.
He had such strong neck muscles, he could just bite onto the chair leg and pick it up with a person sitting in it, which is enormous strength. And Neanderthals were, of course, their major difference from us was that they have thicker bones than any of us ever had, than any of the strongest weightlifter of today. The Neanderthals simply had really thick bones. And so he was doubly sure that he saw the product of inbreeding between us and Neanderthals. And so that was the Snowman Commission, a point of view all the way to the end, until he died, until Porchnip died. And then those that followed in his footsteps, like Jean Josephna Kaufman, who became very well known, she was one of the original members of the commission. And that's why they believed every Almas was this and was a Neanderthal. They did not divide between the giggling little pointed-eared primate that Kochloff talked about, called the Almas, or Almista, and what they clearly saw evidence having once existed, which was a very wild and unusual type of human being, not a delinquent of our own kind. Zana was obviously something very different. Shalakula, her grandson, was proof of a very different type of human being.
You're right.
And that's why, you know, and the Russians had the evidence there for people. And so they, with that evidence, and maybe Zana was indeed a Neanderthal, but they took that and they obliterated the whole reality of the Almas, of the pointed ear, unusual primate, this anthropoid, more like a monkey
right.
than an ape.
Again,
we did the reverse. We took all this evidence in Indian artwork for an anthropoid.
Yeah.
And we obliterated the Indian stories in the Indian artwork of humans, of the same kind of humans. Zana and this mask that's in a museum in Washington, D.C. are almost the same description.
And again, it goes back to this multitude of creatures, and here one of them being human of some kind.
A very wild human.
Right.
A very hairy, wild, thick-set, strong, powerful human, which does match Neanderthals.
Exactly. It's unbelievable stuff. I mean, it's amazing how far astray that it seems mainstream Bigfoot, Sasquatch, you know, Yeti research has gone. That's what strikes me as I read the book.
Well, it is amazing, and that's why I try to highlight the footprints. Here's what we have.
Right.
We even have a footprint that Gene Kaufman found in 1981 in the Caucasus in the land of Zana. In the traditional land of Zana, and that wild man they found in 1941, who's described as like something out of Rice Burroughs, a land that time forgot. You know, long hair on the head and on the chest and on the shoulders, something you'd think Hollywood made up, but this was a genuine six-foot-tall wild man that this military colonel could not explain. And they could not, they had to keep it in an icy room because he could not handle any kind of warm room. And here's his footprint. They find out in the same land of Dagestan and the Caucasus, and it is a footprint that is remarkably similar to those found in ancient caves that we say are Neanderthals. And again, it's not a Yeti footprint. It's not a Sasquatch footprint. It's not a Bigfoot footprint. And yet it does substantiate people in a very certain, consistent type of people, and the same type of footprint was seen melted out by Charles Stoner, who was the deputy lead of the famous Yeti expedition in the Himalayas in 1954, the Daily Mail expedition. And there's a picture in his book, The Sherpa and the Snowman, which looks like it is the same type of footprint, just melted out a bit in the snow. And then we go back, and these mountain climbers who talk about the abominable snowman, the Mito Kongmi, which is what abominable snowman means, is in the original language. And every time Mito Kongmi was said, they were speaking about mountain men, as H.W. Tillman, who was a very famous English explorer, wrote in his own book, which regenerated all this interest in Britain in 1948 in the abominable snowman. He said they were mountain men. They were light-skinned with long hair on their heads, chest and shoulders, just as the colonel, the Russian colonel, described in 1941 in faraway Dagestan. And we said Yeti and abominable snowman are the same, and apparently the same mistake was made, that abominable snowman of the Himalayas were people. The Sherpas insisted they were people. They described them, and it wasn't the Yeti. The Yeti was something totally different to them. That was the cone-headed ape.
Yeah, it's... I'm just...
It does. It gets very convoluted, but the underlying theme is we've obliterated
the truth.
Humans by concentrating on our own folklore. Abominable snowman and the Yeti sounded so fantastic that we just kept the British image of this albino, a cone-headed primate with its hands outstretched, ready to grab onto us. And we forgot that the Sherpas were clearly speaking about people. When they saw this funny human print, that's when they said, Mito Kongmi, abominable snowman.
Yeah.
But when they said, when they were being talked about an animal, then they said Yeti. Mite Yeti. Man-like thing, Yeti, rock dweller. Totally different thing.
And yet, once again, all sort of thrown into the same room.
And then cleaned up when it became so popular, cleaned up as Gigantopithecus. Why? Because we have these fossilized teeth that are huge, primate teeth. We have a fossilized jaw from the Sillimac Hills of India. That's a primate jaw. Had to belong to something. And so we say, well, that's what was dubbed Gigantopithecus. That's all there was. And so we've just reconstructed it into Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Almas, you name it. It's all one thing now, and that's all Gigantopithecus, and that is so false.
Exactly. Well, I thought it was interesting that you say that we have had no good sightings, I presume in America, I'd have to go back and check, but since 1980.
Yes, I would have to say so, not really. I mean, I followed reports, but a really good, clear sighting like that. See, I'm taking that from John Green as well, who is sifting all this stuff.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Because, frankly, I don't think as many people, after the Get Back to Nature a decade, are even out there looking around. And if they are, they're looking for this thing that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
See, that's the whole thing. People are going to say, well, how many entities do you say exist around the world? And why hasn't one been captured? And, well,
right.
We can say, wait a minute, you know, we've got this picture of a dead one, of a Tsonaquah. We just refuse to believe it. That's Amaranthropus loisi.
Mm-hmm.
We have Indian artwork showing that they were talking with a very unusual people that matched the descriptions Russians have of a woman who was captured in the 1880s or 90s in the Caucasus Mountains. We have reports of Almas being captured by the locals, by the Kyrgyz, and maybe we didn't want to believe them. We have evidence that the monks made those famous skull caps in the monasteries in Tibet or Nepal from an actual Yeti that they saw that was killed once. There are reports of an Almas hide in a temple in Tibet. It's ridiculous to say that these have not been captured or explained in very clear histories of the local people. What we have never captured or filmed or truly had a credible witness see is the cone-headed giant of modern legend, because that does not exist.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have Indian artwork showing Sasquatch men. We have Indian artwork showing Tsonaquah. We have Indian artwork showing this unusual Buquat, this wild man that looks like an ape, snarling its teeth, and yet we have the Buquas where they're clearly people.
It's interesting to see how far astray, you know, the American scene is in a way. I'm still struck by that the more I talk to you, because especially how, you know, you point out in the book that this has been going on for like 50 years and it kept getting muddled, and a lot of the main, the biggest quote-unquote evidence for American Bigfoot is the Patterson film, which you say is bogus, and
yes,
the Cripplefoot, which you say is bogus, and, you know, a lot of the flap surrounding Tom Slick's PNE and how that all got started, which sounds like you're, you know, implying that it was sort of all inspired by Ray Wallace and his hijinks.
Oh, absolutely. Ray at Bluff Creek, he was the inspiration for all that, all of his shenanigans with his brother, because that's where PNE, Pacific Northwest or Northwestern Pacific, it has many names, was started. Slick thought that, you know, the news report says Slick thinks Bigfoot kin of abominable snowman. That said everything. He thought he had a Yeti right there because he had been looking for the Yeti in the Himalayas. And so he brought his same crew in and added some of these American woodsmen like Bob Titmus, Renee DeHinden, and John Green, who were very interested. And they concentrated right in the area of Bluff Creek. They were looking for the owner of those funny enlarged human feet that we now know belonged to Ray Wallace, because his nephew Dale showed the exact feet to the world after his death in 2003. And this enormous hail of publicity, because the obituary said Bigfoot is dead. And then they went into it, and he showed the footprints. And if you look at Green's old books, I'm telling you, those are the footprints. The wooden feet that Dale Lee Wallace showed the world are the exact same footprints that are contained in Green's original books, and these are the ones touted as Bigfoot.
And obviously, you know, those revelations in 2002, they were pretty vehemently denied by, you know.
Oh, my gosh, yes. You had ardent Bigfooters. When you get into almost the religious element of Bigfoot, they deeply believe in the popular image. You know, you cannot, I think I wrote in the book, it's like a religion within, you cannot deny a certain vignette that has become very famous. You know, the Albert Ostman stories, the Ape Canyon, the Patterson film encounters, the Bluff Creek encounters in 1958 that started it all, Cripplefoot, these are all within the public persona, the folklore of Bigfoot. It's like a religion. If you say you believe in Bigfoot, if you say you believe in Sasquatch, but you don't believe in one of these crucial vignettes, you're a heretic, and I've been called that. It's like saying I believe in Jesus, but I don't believe the water in the wine episode. You're a heretic.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty...
And that element will do anything to defend the cone-headed giant of modern folklore.
It's amazing. It's like I said, this really shook up my whole understanding of what the hell's been going on here in the world of Bigfoot, because I just thought that this was just an elusive creature here, but now I'm finding out that all the people who've been looking for the elusive creature were, you know, chasing the wrong thing.
Yeah, they were chasing their own phantasm, their own creation, because they didn't bother to look at two different, very different footprints. I mean, yet he was just too popular. Bigfoot could not have gotten, or Sasquatch by effect, the publicity at the time from the media or taken seriously unless someone said, this is the same thing. People don't understand. Yeti is so obscured today because Bigfoot became so popular.
Yeah.
But Yeti was just this enormous, famous thing of the 1950s. 50s, the rage was with cavemen and missing links and the old black and white movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon talking about all this impossible evolutionary theory that Darwin wouldn't even touch in his day, and all the stuff they thought is, you know, was science. That Bigfoot was just so, that Yeti, rather, was just the idea of a caveman, the idea of a missing link was so phenomenally popular, and to actually be able to say it was, to correlate it with bones, with Gigantopithecus. Vladimir Chernyevsky, an anthropologist, was the first to do that, and Bernard Heuvelmans, who became famous as the father of cryptozoology, endorsed all this as well. It was just so, so popular to say, this is a missing link Gigantopithecus. It's a 7-8 foot tall primate with a cone head. If anybody had tried to inject that, listen, we're talking about more than one entity. We're talking about people, and we're talking about a primate, or we're talking about a Native American primate, something from South America, they wouldn't have had a voice.
Right.
They would not have had a market. In order for Bigfoot and Sasquatch to survive, the Bigfooters basically had to say, this is Yeti.
There was once a great American named George Henderson. He met a woodland ape, or Sasquatch, and despite its dangerous message of environmentalism, became his friend. But when the time came to do the hard thing and send it back into the forest where it belonged, and birds could perch on its shoulder because it was gentle, George Henderson summoned the strength, and by God, he did it. Did it hurt? You bet it hurt. Like a bastard. But he did it because it was the right thing to do. For the woodland ape. You think about that.
What?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Is that Harry and the Hendersons?
You've seen it.
This is my life, Jack.